as far as like getting over nerves, being an MC is different than giving a talk. So one thing for talks that I like to do is I like to sprinkle a lot of like memes and things like that throughout my presentation, because not really just to make the crowd laugh, but to make me laugh, because mm-hmm. laughing helps to like relieve those nerves a lot. That's why people laugh awkwardly in like weird situations. So I like,
as we all laugh.
MongoDB World is the conference for developers by developers. Join MongoDB from June 7th to 9th in New York for 3 days of sessions, workshops, and more. For tickets, visit mongodb.com/world-stack and use discount code WORLDPOD25 to save 25%.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Stack Overflow podcast. We have a full house today with Ciara, Cassidy, and Adam joining us. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Hello, hello.
Hello. Okay, we have some exciting things to talk about today. Ciara has got an MC event that we are going to be chatting about. We have one of the largest tech acquisitions in history. One of the largest, not the largest, but one of the largest. We also need to talk about a kidnapped NFT, which personally, I find this quite amusing. Maybe we can start off about this. Is anyone aware of the scandal that has happened recently involving Seth Green?
No. And I would love to know.
Wasn't he had an ape that was supposed to star in a TV show and then the ape got stolen, so now the TV show can't proceed?
That is exactly it. Yeah. What?
So, how is that possible?
Basically, what happened is Seth bought a Bored Ape, which is one of the more popular NFT projects. So specifically, Bored Ape number 8398. And what happened was he decided to name it Fred and turn it into a character for an upcoming TV show that he's a part of. He fell victim to a phishing scam and got a number of NFTs stolen. And because he no longer owns the commercial rights to said NFT, he cannot air the show. So he's kind of between a rock and a hard place, because he can't air this because he no longer has the commercial rights, and he's not able to buy this NFT back from whoever bought it from the nefarious person in the middle.
Gosh.
That's fantastic. That's like fantastic. Phenomenal. Phenomenal is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not a copyright lawyer or IP lawyer or any kind of lawyer, really. But I saw this argument that wouldn't technically, like, the Bored Ape Yacht Club own the actual IP, so they could still assign him the rights to use it commercially, even if he doesn't own the actual ape? Like, don't they own, kind of by our traditional laws, wouldn't they own the copyright on all of the drawings?
I think traditionally, yes, but the whole point of NFTs is that there isn't a central authority that owns anything. It is decentralized, and you own the thing that you own until you don't.
Yeah. Right, and the blockchain tells everybody who the current person is.
So when stuff like this happens, you can't like go to any authority like, fix this, this was stolen from me.
No.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Not much you can do about it. I'm very curious as to what happened if, say, for example, they got the show airs, and then 3 years later, that NFT gets transferred to somebody else. Like, is the copyright ownership then changed at that point in time, even though historically it's being used and getting royalties from a TV show?
I didn't even know that there would like be a copyright issue with NFTs.
Yeah, because people can assign commercial rights over with an NFT. So if you purchase an NFT, then you can then use that in a commercial capacity.
So is that like a new thing?
I learned about it during this podcast.
I saw the news, I think, a day or two ago, but that's all I got.
So I thought like, oh, NFTs are so new and they're unregulated. People are kind of like doing their own thing. Like, that's how you can like get it stolen from you and no one can say anything, because it's like,
I think ultimately it comes down to the fact that none of this has actually been challenged in like a real life court.
Right.
So kind of hard to tell. I mean,
do the laws apply?
The rules seem made up as we go.
Right. That's why I'm like, so why does this rule apply now when it's literally stolen from you?
Yeah, I only know a little bit about copyright stuff. Fun fact, one of my side projects is generating contracts for copyright for creators.
Oh.
Yeah, how about that?
I'm very excited about that. We'll chat later.
Okay. But like, the US Copyright Office is like the strongest copyright that you have. And when you have a copyright and someone steals it, like, it protects you. If someone steals something and you don't have a copyright, you are kind of out of luck generally. But NFTs are very new. And it's a very weird thing with ownership, especially because so many NFT creators have stolen artwork from people where people have copyrighted their art already. And so I think it's still very fuzzy and just not covered yet, kind of like what Adam was saying.
I mean, you don't have to register something for it to be protected by copyright. It's like you create a thing and
I think that's trademark.
The rights.
Copyright has to be registered officially. I mean, like you might like high level own like the intellectual property and stuff, but the only way to guarantee that you're protected is to register a copyright.
With trademarks, you do, I think, at least this is New Zealand law, which is going to apply to a very small amount of the people listening. But you do have to register for a trademark in New Zealand. It's not kind of automatically given. I know with some platforms as well, if you're posting, say, for example, on Instagram or any other platform where your creative work is going, they typically have licenses or some kind of statement in there around copyright and the fact that, like, you know, there was a big issue with people posting content to Instagram and other larger brands reposting that without their consent. And that was all, as soon as it's in the public domain, then it's fair game.
I just found the copyright.gov website and it says, why should I register my work if copyright protection is automatic? And it says it's recommended for a number of reasons. Many choose to register their works because if they really wish to have the facts of their copyright on the public record and have a certificate of registration, registered works may be eligible for statutory damages, attorney's fees, litigation, et cetera, et cetera. So there you go.
Oh, so like me slapping copyrights on like my website and stuff.
So like, it sounds like it's real. It's a little real, but if someone actually steals stuff.
But like if someone stole my website or stole like content from my website, yeah. I really can't like sue them. I wouldn't anyway, but like I really couldn't if I was mad at
them. It sounds like right. That registration is what gives you proof of like the timeline.
Yeah. So you can actually sue them. That's good to
right.
know.
There is such a thing as like the quote unquote poor man's copyright where like, if you send a copy of your own work to yourself, that is considered like the poor man's copyright and it kind of works.
Ah.
Fun fact, but it still doesn't protect you from any copyright law things that come into play.
Just don't lose that envelope.
Yeah, or that NFT.
Speaking of envelopes that you don't want to lose, there was a significant cash handover recently with
wow,
Broadcom.
Nice transition.
Thank you. I feel
you.
Like I'm getting better at these. Yeah. So we have Broadcom, which is the manufacturer and design semiconductors for modems, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth chips. We've most likely used their technology at some stage. They acquired VMware for $61 billion.
Ooh. Yeah. The article says it's one of the biggest tech acquisitions ever. After Dell's $67 billion EMC deal and Microsoft's pending acquisition of Activision Blizzard for $68.7 billion. So it's number three in the list of biggest acquisitions, biggest tech acquisitions ever.
I don't know how much money that is. Like, I can't conceptualize that's like, that at all.
It's some country's GDP.
It's an incomprehensible amount of money. It makes you get philosophical about what else could that money be used for? But I won't get into that.
Exactly. That's for another podcast episode. I wonder how long it takes for these deals to like be thought of and like discussed and then brought to fruition.
A lot. Well, and even once it's announced, there's still so much that has to be done.
The Activision Blizzard one hasn't even gone through yet. And that was announced quite some time ago. So I think these things take a lot of time. Yeah, I'm not sure. Like, have any of you been through an acquisition before and had to deal with that whole process? Because I imagine something like this is a lot of VMware employees are probably thinking like, oh, what's going to happen? Are my ways of working going to change? Is it going to be layoffs, restructures? Like, what has your experience been with?
Yeah, so I've been through a couple. One of them, it was at a creative agency that I worked for, and we were kind of treated as its own company for a very short while. And then we were just like absorbed into the mega company and like the website doesn't exist anymore. And so that's something where it's like that line where it's like, I fell in love with you. Like you fall asleep slowly. And then all at once, that's kind of how the acquisition happened where it was really slow initially where we were kind of left alone. Yeah. We have a parent company. We just get their benefits now. It doesn't matter. And then suddenly everything changed. And that's around the time where I left just because they were taking away certain benefits that we had gotten used to. Even things like creative agency had unlimited vacation, big company didn't. Suddenly we don't have unlimited vacation, yeah. things like that, where just lots of benefits change. And then you could kind of tell that strategy was changing and team structures were changing. And it was definitely changing of the culture. And then another one that I was involved with that ended up being kind of weird was when I was at Venmo, because Venmo had been bought twice, where it was first bought by a company called Braintree, and then it was bought by PayPal. And then PayPal was owned by eBay, and then PayPal and eBay split while I was there. And so it was quite the time where it was like Ventree Pal Bay as a combination of all four, and then all of a sudden the Bay was gone. Something like this, where it's so big and it's already such a big company, I'm sure the absorption will be much slower just because there's a lot more moving parts.
Yeah. Almost like with GitHub and Microsoft, that happened like a couple yeah. years ago. And GitHub is pretty much still its own entity, but they just get like the benefits that Microsoft employees get and the salary that Microsoft employees get too.
My husband works at Microsoft and he tried to like get into the GitHub offices just because he was like, oh, I think I can, right? But they are treated so separately that he can't. Like, it's considered a subsidiary of Microsoft, which I think is a really good way of doing it, where the company, again, gets benefits and stuff, but is a very separate
yeah,
entity.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the thing that current employees would probably want the most.
The thing that's interesting to me about this Broadcom acquisition is the article says that they're now planning to rebrand their Broadcom software group to VMware, which is not usually how this goes.
Oh,
yeah. Usually the company's absorbed.
Isn't at all.
It looks like they're really leaning, because like VMware has a lot of kind of like brand equity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Because I knew VMware and not Broadcom.
Right.
Maybe that's why it's $61 billion you're paying for the brand name, at least in part.
Yeah,
right?
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when companies try to hire influencers and stuff, and they want the influencer to be the face of the brand, and so they get high salaries. It's a thing.
Speaking of which, we actually had Cassidy as a resident influencer for Stack Overflow. Sorry for using the I word, but that was very, very
oh,
fun. For anyone who doesn't know, we had the Stack Overflow dev survey go live earlier on this month, and Cassidy promoted it on a stream, and that was a very fun experience for all of us. So I think, first of all, if you haven't checked out Cassidy's stream, please go do that. And second of all, if you haven't had a look at the Stack Overflow dev survey results, which will be coming out in the next couple of months, please do check that out, because I found them very, very valuable. Siora was a resident MC. Would you like to talk about that experience? And was this the first time MCing for you? Is this something that you've done many, many times before?
This was my second time emceeing, but it was my first time emceeing an in-person event. It was also my first in-person conference, like tech conference ever.
And it was also your first time on a plane, right?
Oh, wow. It was my first time on a plane as well.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I know. I'm like so insane. I should have just been like, I'm going to just chill at my first conference that'll be like local to Philadelphia so I can just drive there. But no, I decided to make my first conference like almost all the way across the country. And it was also the first conference that I had. And I was also the MC. And I brought my younger sister along. So that was fun.
Nice.
So she could also have her first flight before she turns 18. So I was happy about that. And it was an experience.
I mean, for any kind of technical folks out there who are maybe interested in getting into more of the social side, doing conferences, speaking, that kind of thing, like, do you have any advice for anyone who is curious about doing it, but is nervous about the public speaking aspect or even getting on stage and talking to actual real life people for the first time in a very long time?
Yeah, I'll say that I think doing virtual conferences helps because it's a little easier to do it like through a computer. Like, you still get nervous, but like if you're doing it through Zoom or wherever, or Twitch or whatever, it feels more comfortable, like a better stepping stone to just being dropped on stage in front of like 300 people and you just have to like talk. As far as like getting over nerves, being an MC is different than giving a talk. So one thing for talks that I like to do is I like to sprinkle a lot of like memes and things like that throughout my presentation, because not really just to make the crowd laugh, but to make me laugh, because laughing helps to like relieve those nerves a lot. That's why people laugh awkwardly in like weird situations. So I like,
as we all laugh.
I like sparse those throughout because it helps me like relieve the nerves a lot. And then I would say too, I try to make my, like, when I give a talk, I try to make it as natural to me as possible, because the thing that makes me the most nervous is not even just like talking in front of people. It's not even just like, oh, I have to like be technically sound and make sure that all the things I'm talking about are correct. It's really the fact that I'm afraid I'm going to forget something. That's the scariest thing for me. So I have to like, and also I'm a chronic procrastinator. So I'm afraid of forgetting things, but I don't prepare enough to like remember what I'm supposed to say. So if I do an in-person conference where I'm actually a speaker, I'll have to fix that, because I'll be a mess on stage if I feel like I'm going to forget what I have to say. But the cool thing about being an MC is like you get to just like wing it. Like you get to just like not make stuff up, but kind of at the same time. So I don't have to like, there were a couple things that were scripted. Like the introduction was a little scripted because there were things I had to say. And I got nervous for that. Like I was like super nervous because I'm going to forget something. And then it's like going to, the whole conference is going to blow up. And then it's all going to be my fault. So that's like what's going through my head. But after that, I was really comfortable because it's just like, I enjoyed that talk. They talked about this, that, and the third. That was really interesting. We have our next speaker. Like, it wasn't like super scripted. I didn't have to like remember to say certain things. And if I did, that was when I started to get nervous.
The thing that I like to say about like emceeing versus speaking is like, speaking is just kind of a big burst of stress and then you're done with your talk. Emceeing is a very, very light level of stress throughout the day. And so you kind of pick your poison.
That was the thing that was like maybe the hardest was that you have to be on the whole day. Mm-hmm. And then after the conference is over, people are like, oh my gosh, you did so well. So you have to like still be like, oh yeah, thank you. Like you still have to like smile and like be happy and stuff like that, which for me isn't super hard, but it is still, it drains your energy a lot. So like by the halfway point of the conference, I was like dead a little bit, just a little. And like, that's the thing you have to think about if you want to MC versus speaking, because once you, like you said, once you give your talk, you're like done. It's very nerve wracking because it's like 30 minutes, 45 minutes where you have to like stand there and talk. But as the MC, I'm like there the whole time. Like one of the people I know through Twitter, she gave a talk. And like at one point she went back to her hotel room and took a nap and then came back. I could not do that as the MC, which I would have loved to do. But like, you know, so that was one of the things that was like that you have to think about if you're going to be the MC. It's like less stressful in the way that you don't have to worry about like saying your lines and being like smart and making sure everything is correct. But also you have to do it all day, unless it's like a conference where they have like an MC in the morning and a different one at night, but still, or for the afternoon session, I should say.
How do you get into emceeing? So for, you know, if you want to give a talk, you apply to a conference, you know, you get selected, all this kind of stuff. How does one get on this other sidetrack?
I think, and Cassie, you probably know this, I think most of the time for MC, people will reach out to you. That's not really like something you can like fill out a CFP for. I wasn't reached out to. I tweeted that I wanted to be an MC. Oh, well, maybe I kind of was, but I was like, I want
to
MC.
Put it out to the universe.
Yeah, I put it out to the universe and I was like, someone will respond. And then like 30 minutes later, what had happened was one of the employees who I know through Twitter was like, yo, y'all need to like reach out to her because she says she wants MC. We need someone for our event. And then they reached out to me. So that was like through, it wasn't like I just was sitting around randomly like Kent DM'd me like, hey, you want, I like asked basically. I basically was like, I'm going to make this happen because that's what I wanted.
I think that's key though, because you put it out there and then people are aware that you want to. Because I think for a lot of conferences, people don't know how to find MCs because they don't know who might want to. Because it is a tough job. You are on throughout the day. You're kind of like not a speaker, not an organizer, but this weird halfway point because you have to communicate between everybody and stuff. I do think that doing talks first is easier because then you already kind of have a speaking repertoire, and then going into the emceeing side, it's again, it's different, but it's just similar enough where you can kind of put yourself out there in that way. But for talks, you could do what Ciora did and say, I want to give a talk at a conference, and chances are some conference organizer might see it. But also there's a lot of different channels on Twitter. If you just look up the words like CFP or call for papers, call for proposals on Twitter, you will find so many conferences that are asking for people to come and speak. And you can reuse talk proposals. You can reuse talks, write like one or two talks and then send them to multiple events.
Yeah.
Because that talk audience, it might be a larger conference. You might be giving that talk to 300, 500, 1,000 people, but that is a very small percentage of people in the entire industry. And you can definitely overlap it and give talks multiple times. I think some of my talks I've given a solid 10, 12 times before, because it's different people in the audience every single time.
And you change, you get better at it as you do it more. And sometimes yes. you change it as you do it more too. The thing that I did when I was like first trying to get into speaking, I did, like I said, I did like a lot of pre-recorded like talks, but I also started doing them for like boot camps or like local meetups and stuff like that virtually. So that is like, if you're talking to a bunch of people who are learning how to code, who don't maybe know like JS that well or React that well or whatever, and you're talking about that subject, it feels like a lot less pressure because they're not really looking to check you to see if you're like correct or anything like that. They're just happy like that you're willing to speak to them and that like they might learn something from it. So that for me was like a nice like springboard into actually doing like conferences and stuff like that, just because it's lower pressure and you get to get into the habit of speaking and communicating your thoughts and like getting over the nerves and stuff like that. So that's how I started out. I did like a couple boot camps and like local meetups, and then I started to do actual conferences after that, which felt more natural. And then like there are tons of like a lot of the developer newsletters that are out there have like a list of CFPs that are open, and you can just like look through the ones that you feel like would be a good fit for you, that fit your schedule and everything. So yeah, it's like I probably don't fill out, and after a while, like you probably won't even really have to fill out CFPs that often, because people will just start reaching out to you and you'll start having to say no more than anything. But
I think too, everyone has something to teach. You don't have to be the number one expert in a particular field of a particular language or anything to teach a topic. And so if you are interested in any way in speaking, but you're not sure what topic to do, just spend some time, take 10 minutes and just write down everything you know. And don't be so generic like, I know React. What are the different parts of React that you know? Maybe you're really good at use effect or reducers or like class-based components to hooks or something like that. Maybe in JavaScript, you know a lot about string manipulation or how to do one thing particularly well over another thing. Write down just as many things as you can. You have talk topics and you can always refine them, change them, and rearrange them. And it's good to have more voices because you never know how the way you might teach might change how someone else understands them.
That was exactly what I did for my first talk, actually. Like I my first talk I did about developer relations and how you can use YouTube and social media as a technical company or as a technology-led company. I had not been a developer relations engineer or a developer advocate when I did that talk, but I had just seen what other companies were doing well, what other companies weren't doing well. And I put my thoughts on paper and then I submitted it to Twilio for one of their conferences. And that was the first time I did a talk. And it was a really great experience and exposed me to a lot of like very talented people that we had some good conversations from. So I would very much encourage anyone. I found a lot of value out of it because it got me out of my comfort zone a little bit. I saw, you know, like what it was like to prep and what kind of value I could add, I guess, as somebody on the internet. And it was a lot of fun. So I would definitely recommend it.
Ask your coworkers and your friends and classmates and stuff, what do they want to learn from you? Or what do you think you know really well? Because that is also really, really helpful as well. If you are feeling any imposter syndrome and stuff, chances are people who care about you or know what you know are going to be stronger in their opinions of your abilities than you are of yourself.
Adam, have you ever done any technical talks or even like a lunch and learn or something like that where you've presented on a technical topic?
Yeah, I mean, I've done a few kind of internal to the companies that I worked at. I've never done an actual conference talk. Maybe someday. I did some community theater in my past. I do enjoy the attention of being on the stage.
Wow. Cool.
So that's kind of fun. But
you should do it. And a lot of in-person conferences are starting up now, which is cool if you feel comfortable like being around other people and stuff. You know, we're still in a pandemic, unfortunately. The biggest reality check for me was that since I've been in tech, everything I've done has been remote. So I've always worked remotely. I've always been to remote conferences, remote meetups, everything like that. And of course, you hear about like diversity and inclusion and how like it's really bad in tech. And I'm like, yeah, of course. Like, yeah, it's bad, whatever. And I've had a couple like weird experiences at like my past jobs where it was like, man, this is not cool. People are like racist and sexist and stuff like that. But it still was very eye-opening to see like in person that like...
It's jarring.
It was something else. I was like, wow, because there were... I probably could count on both hands how many women were in the whole conference. Yeah. And there was like about, I don't know exactly how many people were there, but it was maybe like 300 people that were there, I think. I don't know. But it was like, whoa. Like I knew it was bad. People say that it's bad, you know. And I've also heard like Chloe Condon. She is a developer advocate. She used to work at Microsoft. She has like a picture that like went viral where she's like at a conference or something like that. Like,
right, where she does like a thumbs up.
Yeah, and she's like standing there. She's literally the only woman and she looks so awkward and she has like her thumbs up. Because that's like, and I've read that when I was like, she wrote an article about it too. I read that when I was getting into tech and I still like, seeing it in person is still very different and experiencing that and being like, whoa, these people weren't lying when they said it was like bad. And no one was rude, thankfully. No one was like rude, but it is just like jarring to see how it is, like in like really see it, how it is in tech. That was like the thing for me that I was like, wow.
It really, it just kind of reignites your fire to be just like, I need to get more women in here. It's one of those things where whenever I've been at an event, it's a constant thing where I'm just like, I can tell if a woman was on the organizing team. I can tell if they had people of color helping out with the code of conduct or moderation or anything like that. You can tell because there has to be so much active effort in that area to make it even close to parody or it's, anything. Yeah. It's definitely challenging and I acknowledge that. And I'm so glad that it was at least a good culture around you, even though you're a deep minority, but yeah.
But yeah, it's just something to think about, like as in-person events start up again, if you are not the typical, I think it typical is the way to put it. You're not the typical.
If you're underrepresented.
If you're underrepresented, that's something you want to consider, is that you may feel uncomfortable standing out that much. And you may also be put in an environment where you are made to feel like you don't belong. That is a huge possibility. And you should keep that in mind. And maybe ask about that if you can. I don't even know how you can ask about like the diversity of the audience. You can always check on the diversity of the speaker panel before you even say like yes to anything. I think that's something you should always do. I know there are some people who have like a specific criteria, like at least such and such percentage of the speakers must be underrepresented. Like, so that's something you should definitely try to do. But just be prepared to not find a lot of people who look like you or come from the same background as you. That's like something you definitely want to prepare for, especially if you've never done in-person events like me before. So that was like, whoa.
Something that some organizers did, again, pre-pandemic, before all of this world stuff, that I think was really, really great, is there was an option when you bought a ticket to have like a check mark saying like, I want to be connected to other underrepresented people at this event. And then you could have like a mini meetup at the actual conference. And so I'd go to a hackathon and I'd say, okay, I'm going to be working on my projects and stuff, but I know at this time I should be at this place because that's where all the women are going to be hanging out. Or this is where like the Latinas in computing meetup is going to be, or something like that, where you can be with people who look like you or who might have your back or who understand that level of discomfort that you might have. And then you can kind of go out of that with some new friends and a new community and stuff. And it's something that I do think some people object to, particularly people who are in the majority, because they're like, well, how is that inclusive if they get their own meetups and we don't? But people who are in the majority automatically have a community when they're in this tech industry, when they look around and there are a bunch of people who look like them. And like you said, Ciara, because there weren't as many, you kind of huddle together and you're like, there's some of us. I think it's good for organizers to keep that in mind, especially as we are coming into more in-person events, to have those kinds of opportunities for people to connect with others that might be uncomfortable doing so otherwise.
I can provide a little bit of a different context and hopefully more of a silver lining for anyone who might be feeling underrepresented. Because at the moment, we're talking very much about like North America, like the North American tech scene. And just from my experience with tech, you know, it being 4 years, I've worked in New Zealand and Amsterdam. I've either been very lucky or fortunate or very intentional around the companies that I've worked for. And the fact that like the first team I joined, the senior developer on the team was woman. My product manager, the two product managers were women. The next team that I joined, again, it was me and then a senior female lead and then another junior female lead. So like a lot of the teams that I've been in have actually been majoritively women. So for anyone who I guess might be feeling a little bit underrepresented or like there's no hope, it seems like the North American market has got a very long way to go, but at least my experience in New Zealand and Amsterdam, like, it seems like there's a lot more diversity there.
And I think also it's one of those things where, Ciara, I'm very grateful that you spoke at that event and emceed it, because you were representing that, representing the underrepresented. And I think you can't be what you can't see. And so if people are interested in speaking, they might be inspired because you did. And if you want to help pay it forward and lift as you climb in your career, and you are in an underrepresented group, it would be awesome to see you amongst all the speakers and stuff. And I'm not saying that people who are in the minority should be putting in more work, because that is not what I mean at all. But if it's something that interests you, I think people would welcome you with open arms, and we'd love to see more representation amongst speakers so that events can be more inclusive and diverse overall.
And I think it definitely comes like at a cost, mm-hmm. but it's not a complete loss, I should say. Like, those are things like you should think about. I just want to be completely transparent about like what it's really like. So like, if you decide that I want to speak, I want to do in-person events, just know what to expect, especially if it's not a conference that's focused specifically on like diversity or something like that. Those are like things that you should keep in mind, because it's definitely something that has to happen.
We have one recommendation. This is actually a recommendation that I was excited for Cassidy to have a look at. Logitech have just released their first like Bluetooth mechanical keyboard with brown, linear, and I think another switch. I thought this might be of interest to you. You can't customize them, but they're part of their MX Master line, which has been very synonymous with developers and productivity over the last little while. So I thought I'd give that a shout out. Adam, you had something as well that you wanted to...
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to quickly call out a thing that I learned about this week. And it's this website that has a bunch of roadmaps and guides and various educational things for helping people learn how to become developers or learn specific technologies. And it's roadmap.sh. Ooh. And there's multiple roadmaps there, so I just kind of want to say it as roadmaps. Hopefully remember it that way. But it's very cool. Check it out.
I've seen this before, and it was actually incredibly useful. Just like looking back with hindsight, I guess, the developer roadmap, I mean, like, oh, I wish I would have done that. So it is genuinely useful, and I would encourage having a look. Moving on to our lifeboat. A lifeboat is an answer score of 20 or more to a question score of -3 or less. Today's lifeboat goes out to Munk, M-U-N-K, for answering the question, Python pass as a string. Thank you very much for being part of our community. That wraps up our episode today. Thank you so much to Ciara, Cassidy, and Adam for joining us this week on the podcast. Everyone like to do their handles, shout outs, everything else. Ciara, if you want to start.
Sure. My name is Ciara Ford. I'm a developer advocate at a place that will soon to be announced. You can find me on Twitter. My username there is Ciorio. That's C-E-E-O-R-E-O _.
My name is Cassidy Williams. You can find me at Cassidoo, C-A-S-S-I-D-O-O, on most things.
And I'm Adam Lear, staff software engineer at Stack Overflow. And you can find me on Twitter at AA Lear.
And I'm Matt Kiander. I'm a developer advocate here at Stack Overflow. You can find me online at Matt Kander, M-A-T-T-K-A-N-D-E-R on Twitter and all the other things. Thank you so much for tuning in. Appreciate your time. And we will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.